From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Leaked secret documents that expose lies and corruption on a massive scale. They're the gift that keeps on giving. Before Julian Assange and Edward Snowden, the Panama Papers, and the Paradise Papers, the release of the Pentagon Papers set the standard for forcing government secrets into the light. This holiday season, there's a new movie based on the Washington Post's decision to publish those papers. It was a courageous move because the Nixon administration had already sued the New York Times for printing them first. In the film, Tom Hanks plays the Post's executive editor, Ben Bradley, and Meryl Streep is publisher Katharine Graham. The Pentagon Papers lawsuit led the nightly news, while the Post and its lawyers grappled with the stakes of picking up where the Times left off.
The New York Times was barred from publishing any more classified documents dealing with the Vietnam War.
If you publish, we'll be at the Supreme Court next week.
Meaning?
Well, we could all go to prison.
Turns out, someone familiar to our newsroom at Reveal was more than a bystander to the Pentagon Papers.
I was at a friend's place,
Okay, I heard a laugh there. What's the laugh? What was going on at the friend's
place? I was also high, I guess, smoking a joint.
That's Robert Rosie Rosenthal, our recently retired executive director at the Center for Investigative Reporting. He's talking to Reveal's Michael Corey. Now, Rosie is our Clark Kent. Mild-mannered, soft-spoken, even cloaking a secret identity. Today, he'll help explain how that identity intersects with history. It's 1971, and Rosie is about 6 months into an entry-level job at the New York Times.
And the phone rings, and, you know, we didn't pay any attention, but then I hear his mother's voice saying, Robert, she called me Robert, Robert, it's for you. So I'm going, who knows I'm here?
It was one of the top editors at the Times. He told Rosie, don't come into the newsroom in the morning. Go to room 1111 of the Hilton Hotel.
Don't tell anyone where you're going, and bring enough clothes for at least a month. You know, I was like, what?
So Rosie showed up the next day, and the Times had set up a whole mini newsroom in the middle of this giant hotel, where they figured no one would notice them if they were careful.
You're going to be working on a really incredible story that is top secret. It involves the U.S. government, and it's going to be risky. And I remember saying, risky? What's risky? Well, within a few hours, I was Xeroxing the Pentagon Papers and looking at things that said, you know, top secret for your eyes only.
The Pentagon Papers, a trove of classified documents on the Vietnam War. When the New York Times published them in 1971, set off a chain reaction that helped bring down a president. It also marked a turning point in how many Americans saw their government. This was the moment when people learned that the government lied, and lied on a grand scale. Back when Rosie was 22 years old, he had a front row seat.
That whole experience for me really shaped my career in terms of taking risk and working with great people and understanding the power of the press. And it was fun. It was really fun.
Rosie shares a particular bond with the government insider who leaked the papers, Daniel Ellsberg. The two guys spent more time than probably anyone else on Earth secretly copying the Pentagon Papers, all 7,000 pages. Ellsberg and Rosie have known each other for a while, but they've never sat down and talked in detail about their experience. So we went to Ellsberg's house.
Thank you for doing this.
I'm used to getting filmed here a lot. They don't have such fancy sound equipment.
They ended up talking for hours. Now, one of the things they remembered was how much work it was to just copy the documents. It took Ellsberg a year.
I got very jealous later of these machines, you know, and they collate.
Yeah, not that kind of copy machine. This is old school. Open the big heavy cover, put one page in, close the cover, press start. Wait. Open cover, repeat, 7,000 times.
Page by page. And finally, it was just too slow, so I would put it in without putting the heavy cover on and wondering what this was going to do to my eyes. You know, I was possibly going to go blind eventually.
I remember the green light, the green ray, thinking, is this going to sterilize me?
Oh, so you had the same concern.
Before Edward Snowden showed us the NSA could spy on all of us, Before Chelsea Manning exposed hundreds of thousands of secret diplomatic cables, there was Daniel Ellsberg. He's the grandfather, the OG, original gangster whistleblower. History generally remembers Ellsberg as a hero, a champion of free speech. On the other hand, Snowden is in exile in Russia, and just before President Obama left office, he pardoned Chelsea Manning from a 35-year sentence in a military prison. So, what's the difference? Well, not as much as you might think. At the time of the leak, all the same things people say about Snowden and Manning now, they're traitors, they're threatening national security, people said about Ellsberg too. He was charged with espionage and he expected to go to prison, but somehow he got away with leaking classified government documents. But this isn't just a history lesson. You can draw a straight line from what happened in the 70s to today and the debate over government secrets and what happens to the people who expose them. Here's Reveal's Michael Corey with a story we first brought you in May of 2016.
Most of us have at least heard of the Pentagon Papers. What I remember from high school is that they're about Vietnam, they got leaked to the press by some guy named Daniel Ellsberg, and it was a big deal. The Pentagon Papers were a thing, then Watergate happened. But if that's what you learned in school, you missed the important part. I never learned it this way, but without the Pentagon Papers, there would probably be no Watergate. And maybe no Nixon resignation. And that's the story I'm going to tell today. First off, who is this guy Ellsberg?
Well, my early life was spent entirely playing the piano because my mother's ambition for me was that I should become a concert pianist.
That didn't happen. When Ellsberg was 15, his mother and sister were killed in a car crash. He and his father survived, but he wasn't destined to be a pianist. And Ellsberg didn't start out a radical. Like many young Americans in the 1950s, he was deeply patriotic. He graduated from Harvard, did a fellowship in England. Then, in 1954, he ditched the pacifism of his Christian Science parents and joined the military. And he didn't mess around. Ellsberg signed up with the Marines.
I wanted to see if I was up to it. You know, there was a Marine poster that said, "Are you man enough to be a Marine?" And well, like a lot of people, I wanted to find that out.
Ellsberg was up to it, and he even re-upped and served on a ship during the Suez Crisis. For a while, his life was basically the Marines, Harvard, the Marines, Harvard. Who does that? Finally, he got a PhD in what's called decision theory. It's a dry-sounding corner of academia that asks, how should people make rational choices when confronted with uncertainty? But in 1958, this wasn't a theoretical question. It was a question about nuclear weapons, specifically the big scare of the time, intercontinental ballistic missiles.
So that was the period of the so-called missile gap, where it was understood that the Soviets would have a large force of ICBMs before we did.
By 1961, Ellsberg had started consulting for the Kennedy administration and was now directly involved in planning America's nuclear war strategy. In this era, that strategy was called First Strike, meaning we launch our nuclear weapons before the other guy does. Suddenly, instead of abstract research, Ellsberg was deeply engrossed in some of the nation's greatest secrets. And he found that in nuclear war, there was plenty of uncertainty. Like, how could the president decide quickly if an incoming attack was a false alarm?
If he waits too long, he won't have anything to respond with. So the incentive to get planes off the ground in particular, and even perhaps to commit missiles, is very strong, and yet there's a possibility of a false alarm. And that could have meant a war being triggered by these warnings on either side.
If that sounds like a movie you've seen, you're right.
I went with my boss, Harry Rowan, to see Dr. Strangelove in the afternoon in D.C. because it was a working problem for us.
If you haven't seen Dr. Strangelove, after you finish listening to this episode, drop whatever you're going to do next and watch it. It's a comedy about nuclear war. Hilarious, right?
If we were to immediately launch an all-out and coordinated attack on all their airfields and missile bases, we'd stand a damn good chance of catching them with their pants down.
In this scene, a rogue commander has launched American planes carrying nuclear bombs, and a general, played by George C. Scott, is arguing that maybe the president should let the planes drop them.
But it is necessary now to make a choice, to choose between two admittedly regrettable but nevertheless distinguishable post-war environments. One where you got 20 million people killed and the other where you got 150 million people killed.
You're talking about mass murder, General, not war.
Mr. President, I'm not saying we wouldn't get our hair mussed, but I do say no more than 10 to 20 million killed, tops.
And I remember we came out of that movie and we both said, that's a documentary. It was a documentary. Everything in that thing, aside from the laughs, everything could have happened just the way as in the movie. For example, the fact that they had no way to call the planes back once they had given a go order.
Ellsberg wondered if the Joint Chiefs of Staff had ever even totaled up how many people would be killed if the U.S. carried out its first strike plan against the Soviet Union and China. He asked. He figured he'd embarrass them because there was no way they had done that. But as he told me and Rosie, it turned out they had.
So that was a total of 600 million, which was 100 Holocausts. And this was from our first strike. So any fighting with Soviet troops, we carry out this attack first, right away, and kill 600 million people.
So you're 30 years old. You're getting access to documents that say top secret, eyes of the president only, and you have this number in your head. At that moment, if you go back to it, what was your reaction?
I remember my reaction very, very well. I thought, this is the most evil plan that has existed in the history of the human species. This is an evil piece of paper. It shouldn't exist.
But Ellsberg knew, better than most people, that this wasn't just a piece of paper. He knew because he wasn't the kind of analyst who stayed in his office. He had visited the airfields and actually touched one of the bombs.
I had seen the planes on alert, 10-minute alert. I'd felt one of the bombs, actually. I remember I happened to be lying there on a trolley, and it was warm from radioactivity.
Ellsberg says he tried to push the Kennedy administration to make the war plan less rigid, but he didn't really get anywhere.
I don't think I had any effect.
So if he couldn't get Washington's hand off the nuclear hair trigger, the only hope he saw was to keep any small conflict from escalating. And it just so happened there was a small conflict that was about to explode in Vietnam.
When we come back, we pick up the story of the Pentagon Papers, next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.